Adnan Iqbal is CEO and co-founder at Luma Health, a company which better connects patients and doctors. He's raised over $29 million and scaled to over 300 US clinics. Adnan studied biology at Berkeley, then did his master's at Cambridge, before working at Genentech, a large US biotech company. He then did his MBA at Stanford, and that's when him and his co-founder Tashfeen, a medical doctor, started working on Luma. This episode is laced with gems of advice from Adnan, and we spend a lot of time talking about the early days of Luma and how he got those initial customers on board. We also discuss some of his thinking and decision-making as CEO and what it's like to be a Pakistani dude in Silicon Valley. I hope you enjoy.
People are waiting weeks to months to be able to get to care in the outpatient setting, right? Like, I'm sick today, my loved one's sick today, and I'm waiting weeks to months to be able to get into the clinic. And I played soccer as an undergrad at Berkeley. I tore my ACL my sophomore year. I called the Palo Alto Medical Foundation to get an MRI scheduled. They told me I should wait 3 weeks and an appointment would open up. Right, a pretty par for the course experience for most patients. And I was that annoying dude who, on a Monday in between classes, because I had some free time and because I really wanted to get back on the soccer field quickly, I called them 10 times on Monday. Right, Tuesday, an appointment opened up. I had my MRI. And Friday, I had surgery. So I was on my path to healing in 4 days rather than waiting 3 weeks to get the process started. And the reality for me was, you know, I was in my early 20s. I could have crushed around for 3 weeks and I would have been fine. Right, I would have gone to the same health outcome just 3 weeks later. But the reality for most Americans in our experience was, and you're waiting 2.5 to 12 weeks just to get to care. And every single day that goes by, your likelihood of a better health outcome is deteriorating, right? And that's really the problem statement that we focused on. And as we dug into it, really wanted to test, was this unique to us? And our own experience was unique to the imaging world. So Tashfeen, as a radiologist, saw the same, where he had patients waiting up to 6 weeks to see him. And then every day when he came in, there's 8 to 10 openings in his calendar. We wanted to test, was problem true across the spectrum of healthcare. And so just being good nerds on campus, we ran a study with a little over 100 different healthcare providers. So doctors who worked at clinics with 2 or 3 doctors, all the way up to the very large complex health systems that employ thousands and thousands of providers, and everyone in between, your integrated delivery networks, your accountable care organizations, your academic hospitals, your safety net hospitals, your large multi-specialty private clinic network, and then of course your independent physician groups. And what we found is the average person, the average American, is waiting 2.5 to 12 weeks to get to care. And the same clinics or same doctors, whether it's 2 doctors or thousands and everyone in between, they're sitting on about a 15 to 30% unused capacity in any given day. So people waiting for needing care, they're being care available, but no simple, easy way to connect those patients to care. And that really for us was the starting point where we said there's got to be a real-time, automated, text-first way. No app, no download, no portal, no login, no friction way to 1, identify patients you're waiting for care, 2, identify real dynamic availability and clinic schedule, and then 3, the magic one is how do you make sure you match the right patient to the right care? So that's really where it all began, and it was a quote-unquote smart wait list that was looking to match patients to the right care, and that's really where our journey began with Luma Health, and now we've, of course, grown up to focus on a set of problems that encompass that, but at a much higher level, and that's far more pronounced across the spectrum of healthcare. Really, that's patients really struggle to hold a clinic, and clinics really struggle to hold a patient, not just at the onset, but at any given point along a patient's journey through healthcare. And so that's really, we've become the end-to-end patient communication, or we call the patient relationship platform.
So one part of that story that's quite stood out is when you kind of noticed this problem, and then it sounds like you did some kind of guerrilla kind of study to work out how long people were waiting and across different providers. Can you talk me through that kind of initial research phase in the study? How did you go about getting that sort of data?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, early on when we were both on campus, you know, I think part of it was just being on campus at Stanford, where there's a whole culture of innovation and entrepreneurship. And, you know, there's just so many resources that make it easy for one to play startup. So we were very fortunate in, you know, in being, you know, on that campus at that time. And this was an idea, and we you know, Tashfeen had you know, Tashfeen is a wizard of a human. He's a self-taught he's a practicing physician. He's a self-taught coder. He has built websites and apps for all these different things. And so he started a prototype, and what we quickly started to do was, for all of our different classes we took, we would use what's now Luma Health as, you know, that class project to be able to test different things, right? From the computer science classes that I was taking, I would use, you know, what Tashfeen started with as a prototype and build on top of it for my computer science classes. For my, you know, business school VC fundraising strategy course, I would use the idea of what's now Luma Health is, you know, how do you build out the financial model and justify your expenses and investment required, et cetera. But the real key thing for us was like, that was all hypothetical and conceptual, and it was good because it was putting structure around something that was an idea. But most importantly, it was, and I think this was, you know, something we learned on campus from the design school at Stanford, was you can think through an idea, you can analyze it and assess it in every shape, way, and form, but there's nothing more valuable and more important than getting, even if it's a poopy prototype or just a shell of a prototype, in front of real people, right? And for us, that was critical. And that's where we said, hey, we need to get this in front of clinics, hospitals, and health systems, right? People who will ultimately be using it, who will be buying it, and really benefit from their feedback. And that's where we decided to run this study with 100 different healthcare providers across the spectrum of healthcare, from clinics and physician groups, and regional mid-market networks, and then of course your large enterprise health systems. And the great thing is, when you're a student, everyone talks to you happily and freely, right? There's no agenda. And everyone is also very candid and transparent. And so we got invaluable feedback early on as to, you know, hey, this was a cute idea, but what it would take for it to become real. And I remember we were, you know, two dudes with an idea and a smile and a handful of PowerPoint slides. And we had a chance, because we were on campus, and could play the student card, to present to Stanford's health system, and their chief operating officer invited us in to present to their leadership team. And that was 45 minutes of just getting like punched in the face, right? But it was the most invaluable 45 minutes, in that we really started to uncover, this is a good idea, right? But it is just an idea right now. And this is solving a real set of problems. These are a set of connected problems, but this is the long list of things that we have to address and be sharp on and be able to speak to if we want a health system with a sophisticated IT team, an applications team, a risk-averse technology team, an operational team that's, you know, been burned by technology. How do they think about different things for this to actually become something they would implement? Even though they understand the problem, they understand the solution, but there was a long gap in between that we had to figure out how to cover. And that was the best part of just kind of, you know, you described it as kind of guerrilla tactics, but just roll up your sleeves and dive into the mud, as opposed to just thinking about it and strategizing and building slides and models. It was best to actually just go get punched in the face by real users and real people, because that made us so much stronger as we actually then decided to launch the company.
I think the quote is, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face.
Exactly.
I know you kind of described yourself as two dudes with a smile, and you mentioned the benefits of being within the Stanford system. But do you have any kind of tips for that initial phase of, you know, you're two students with this idea and you're going around to different health systems, people kind of, you're punching up, you're going above your pay grade, and you're trying to get these people's attention and feedback. Do you have any advice on, you know, getting through gatekeepers and getting into those conversations?
Yeah, so I think that's actually the best time, because the gates are lowered, right? And everyone enjoys spending time with students, with people who are intellectually curious, who have ideas, who are looking for feedback and advice. Because when you're a student, you're not selling anything, right? Just by saying I'm a student, that you could say I'm a student working on a startup, I'm a student working on an idea, I'm a student exploring this approach or solution set. People will immediately, you know, lower the force fields, right? And that this is not a salesperson trying to sell me stuff. These are students. They're sharp. They're intellectually curious, and they want my advice and my feedback. And that's the best time, right? You know, there's like the old saying that when you ask for money, you get advice, or when you're trying to make a sale, you get some feedback. But when you ask for feedback or advice, that's when you get the investment, or you get a potential customer, or someone's like, yeah, I'll try that, right? And so that for us was actually the most invaluable part, was just leveraging the fact that we're students and we had questions and we're really open to feedback and guidance and thoughts, and we want people to react to what we had. And that was invaluable. And there was no bad data point early on, right? Every data point was valuable. It allowed us to really identify trends, identify what was lacking, what was missing, etc. But that to me is, I'd say, you know, if I were to give myself advice back then, it's start that process even earlier. It's the minute you have an idea, start to get real feedback, get it in the hands as quickly as possible. It doesn't have to be a real product or anything yet. Just could be, you know, a set of prototypes. Get it in the hands of real people, because that feedback is invaluable.
So take me back. So you noticed this problem, and how does Luma go about tackling it? Like, what were your first steps?
Yeah, you know, what we found is this wasn't a new problem, right? It'd been it's a problem that's it's been around a long, long time. And what we found is folks were solving it in two ways. One, they were potentially just double and triple, quadruple booking patients, right? Because they knew that they have always a large amount of demand and that the supply varies, right? That when you look at a clinic schedule or a hospital health system schedule, everything looks booked. And then within a 48-hour window, it's really turning over, right? Because people are people and their lives change and things they scheduled 6, 12, even 3 weeks ago just can't be real anymore, right? Because your schedule has changed. And so there's a lot of short notice kind of change and turnover. And so we said, hey, and that's when people were double and triple, quadruple booking and said like, hey, on average, right, I'm going to have availability on a typical Tuesday or typical Wednesday because I have a 15 to 30% unused capacity rate. Now, of course, what that meant for patients is that's a terrible experience in on those days where people do show up, right? And you are waiting 45 minutes in a waiting room to then go sit in another room to wait another 45 minutes before the doctor comes in, spend 7.5 minutes with you, and off you go, right? And I think what we found is this is a function of timing is, and this was always our view, is that there will come a time where, in our case, the U.S. healthcare system will finally start to think about the patient as a customer and want to own and automate that entire patient journey. And what that meant is you have to deliver a good experience alongside a good health outcome and a good intervention, right? And so if a patient is waiting 2 hours to see you before they get in with you and spend 7 minutes with you, that patient's going to go online and leave a nasty review, right? I mean, and that's a real risk now to your ability to be a good business and to attract patients to your hospital, your health system, your clinic. And so that's that was kind of part one of the problem. Part two of the problem was the way people were trying to solve it is throw more bodies at it. It's like, okay, I don't want to double and triple book, so I'm going to hire more people to call patients, right? Where I come in the morning, I know, okay, today I have this 15, 30% use capacity and I know these people waiting weeks to months. Let's start calling them. Maybe they can come in today. Maybe they can come in tomorrow. And the reality in today's world is people just don't pick up their phone. Like no one picks up their phone, right? So what we found is that the average health system was making 20 calls, right, to reach a single patient. Otherwise, we're just leaving voicemails. And so that's where this automated, text-first approach, SMS-first approach really made sense. Because we found that your average adult will see a text message in 90 seconds and will respond within 10 minutes. Right, it's just it's a form of communication that's so easy. It's so part of our life. And unlike email, which people will see and then say, "I'll get back to it," and I'll come back to it 2 weeks later. Right, the response is really within 10 minutes. And also, people aren't annoyed by text. You can text message a patient or a person 3-4 times a day, and they're not irritated. If you email them more than twice, they're looking for the unsubscribe button. Right. So that was the early power of what we started with, and of course, that allowed us to uncover a broader set of pain points. And also hand in hand, started to see clinics, hospital health systems really also change their viewpoint in terms of, okay, we have to think of the patient as a customer. In fact, we have to think about a patient, not just as a customer, but a person, and treat them as a person, right? Where they'll reply with paragraphs, right? They'll use emojis. They'll do all the things we do in our normal everyday communication. They expect the same from their health system and their health provider. And just like people expect choice, information, et cetera, and every other part of their life, they expect the same from healthcare. And that's really the transition we've seen here over the past 6 years as we've been on our journey as a company and are really seeing now the market meet, you know, what we've been pushing uphill, right? Changing hearts and minds. The market's finally meeting it and pulling for it. But it took 6 years.
That's interesting because the trend you're talking about, I think I've noticed it in email newsletters as well, where I think like online blogs were really hot and now people have kind of gone back in time and thought, you know what, a newsletter is much better. People are more likely to see it. And, you know, with your approach, it's like people were like, you know, digital apps are amazing. Let's make this patient portal. But actually an SMS works so much better. So it's interesting that that's kind of what you landed on.
Yeah, we found that, you know, portals, every health system, clinic, hospital tried portals. Or it was supposed to be the, you know, the magic thing that made everything better. And portals have been total poop, right? No one engages with the portal. No one logs in a portal. You forget your password. You know, average person engages with healthcare twice a year. And so portals failed miserably, continue to fail miserably. And then a couple of years later, it was all about, hey, we have to have an app. And every health system was looking to hire a product manager and a handful of developers to build an app or to buy an app from, an Epic or what have you. And, you know, we purposefully, when we launched the company in 2015, decided to take an app-less approach because we found that, broadly speaking, there's a lot of app fatigue. And specifically for healthcare, apps are really, really hard, right? It's not like your banking app or your restaurant app or your you know, ride sharing app, which you're going to engage with at least once a week or once a month. You're looking at a healthcare app you engage with multiple times during a specific acute period of your life, or twice a year, three times a year. And again, we found that even with MyChart, which is, you know, Epic's big app, and health systems that are very well resourced, like a Stanford Health System or a UPMC, they could spend buku marketing bucks and get people to download it, right? And so they would get the 75-80% download and activation rate. But they either wouldn't track, or if they did track, they'd find their routine engagement rate was all sub 20%. In fact, the best way that they had to get a hold of their patient wasn't a portal, wasn't an app, it was a phone, right? Patients calling into the health system and the health system calling the patient. So their contact center was still the best thing they had, even in a very modern world, right? And so that kind of was just, you know, that moment for us, like this absolutely makes no sense. And we need to take a text first approach. So that's been powerful. And another part of it really has been, you know, it's a desire to treat people like people and as a customer, right? Where people have more choice. They no longer have to go to healthcare to get healthcare. Right? You can get healthcare in a lot of different places now that are not traditionally healthcare. You can get it at Walmart, right? You can get it at a CVS pop-up clinic. You can get it if you have a smartphone. You can have a health coach, you know, on your phone. And so health systems have finally realized that, hey, we have to be able to understand and treat these people like customers and as people. Otherwise, we're never going to get the chance to get them in the door and to provide the care that we need, and we won't have the opportunity to capture the lifetime value of that patient as a customer.
So can you take me through the next step? So how did you get providers on board with your idea?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the greatest pieces of advice we got early on was you have to lead. Two things. One is if you have to explain the problem, you've already lost, right? Like whoever you're working with, they have to feel the problem like deep, you know, within their core. And so that for us was a check, right? Everyone knew this was a real problem. They were trying to solve it in all different ways. Double, triple booking, more people calling, right? It was a real known challenge, and folks knew that this is causing me pain. It's lost revenue. It's a missed opportunity to provide care to patients, et cetera. So that was part one of the advice we got. Second piece of advice we got is, you know, it's insufficient to just talk about improvements in health outcome or improvements in terms of cost efficiency, right? You actually have to lead with what's the value. And ideally, the value is top line revenue growth. And underneath it, you can talk about the cost savings and the efficiency, how you drive and deliver better health outcome. But the rubber hits the road when you can talk about and deliver very tangible financial ROI. And for us, right, by getting patients in sooner, keeping the schedule full, right, early on, what that meant is we were able to show a 5 to 10x return on investment month over month, right, immediately, right, where people could see, okay, Luma has helped me bring patient butts into seats. Luma is helping me bring patient butts back into seats. And so I can count exactly how many patients Luma helped me capture. And there's real revenue associated with that, right? Now, on top of that, it was really helpful for them to see, okay, my patients who get in sooner, who are not waiting 2, 6, 12 weeks, when they get in sooner, they're on a improved likelihood for a better health outcome, right? Because we were able to engage and intervene with them sooner. So that was a benefit. And then of course, those, you know, who are a bit more astute would say, okay, also, if my staff no longer have to make, you know, 20 calls on average to reach one patient, if they're not calling people, you know, 3 to 5 p.m. every day, if I don't have this massive contact center doing a bunch of outbound calls, leaving voicemails, that's an area for me to reduce costs, right? Because I can have less people spend time on that, or I can reallocate those folks to higher value work, right? To spending time with the patient, to working with insurance companies, what have you. So that was kind of that triangle approach for us that really worked was top line revenue growth, improved patient outcomes, and then of course some cost benefits and efficiency. But the latter two were nice sub bullet points. If we didn't have the leading, hey, with Luma Health, you will see a 5 to 10, 10 to 30x return on investment month over month. I don't think it would have mattered. And unfortunately, you know, there are tons and tons of really promising digital health startup, digital health apps, et cetera, that can really only make one or two of those claims, either health outcome or efficiency alone or both. But again, if you can show revenue, that's what's differentiating in this market in terms of really being able to build a lasting company that can deliver revenue and other outcomes and efficiencies that are incredibly important.
You've mentioned a few times some good advice you received along the way, but were there any pieces of bad advice you received?
Not really. You know, I think people, again, when you're a student, people want to give you good advice. No one's looking, they want to support you and make sure that you, you know, don't make mistakes that potentially they made or they've seen other groups or companies make. You know, the other piece of advice that was really helpful for us was speed to market and speed to impact really matters, right? And the scarcest resource for early stage startup isn't capital, it's actually time, right? And so we, our very first pilot was with the University of Maryland's Academic Medical Center. And that was the worst place to start because it's a very complex bureaucratic organization. And that's no fault of their own, that's just how they're organized. But as a team of two or three people, we would have spent 18 months just trying to get to a formally approved scope deployed pilot. And it would have been 18 months later, and the product probably would have been customized so much as to meet the need of that one system that it wouldn't be something that we could replicate other places. And so the advice we got early on was you either have to raise a buttload of capital if you want to start with health systems as a starting place, so you have to kind of suck it up for 18 months, or you start with clinics and physician groups first, where you have the ability to get the product in real users' hands, real patients' hands within weeks, right? And of course, you have people who are bought in to be a part of the solutioning and helping you understand the broader pain points. And that's allowed us to go from a set of communication features to a full suite of enterprise products. That was really good advice. Bad advice, you know, I think, I wouldn't say it's advice, but I think often folks highlight the good stories, right? Like all those positive outliers, right? Everyone talks about, of course, you know, the Steve Jobs and the Bill Gates and the Musks of the world. Okay, fine. But even, you know, if you take like those kind of iconic names out of it, the stories people highlight is, oh, you know, I was on Caltrain going from Palo Alto to San Francisco, and I happened to be sitting next to someone and I was talking about my idea, and it turned out they were like this VC at this, you know, leading venture capital firm. And, you know, I was holding two coffees and I gave him one of the coffees. And by then I had a 45-minute train ride. You know, I had my investor, and like the next day I got my term sheet, right? Like you hear a lot of these, like, oh, like it all just kind of happened. And I think, that for a first time founder is bad. It's, you know, I don't want to call it, it's not advice. Those are just like anecdotes of what you hear. That's bad advice, right? Cause the reality is it's a slog, and you will get punched in the face, day in, day out, right? And there's a lot of valleys and few peaks, and you appreciate the peaks. You know, it takes a lot of kind of stick-to-itiveness to be able to get through those early stages of building a business. And I think folks often don't talk more, they should talk more about that, right? And they talk more about the peaks, right? And those bright, shiny outliers, rather than giving folks like a true picture of what it takes. And I think just being authentic and honest about that actually is better serves founders at any stage, but especially first-time founders.
Would you mind talking about maybe a low point in your kind of story with Luma Health where you thought things weren't going to go well?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have endless examples, right? I mean, and that's just, and any honest founder would tell you the same, right? It's always easy to be like, yeah, we're crushing it, right? And we have so much demand, and like I have VCs that I'm fighting off, and there may be truth to that. But you know, a lot of that is unfortunately just kind of founder bravado. Most founders are like, you know, or have sleepless nights agonizing about, oh my God, like that one part of the product, it's so shaky. Like if that doesn't work, like this whole thing is going to unravel, right? You honestly have to fake it till you make it, right? And that's the honest truth, and that's okay, because that's how you get better and build. And so a couple examples. You know, one is from a product standpoint and a patient impact standpoint. You know, early on, we would really force ourselves to work with larger and larger clinics and health systems, right? And what we were working with probably 10 different clinics, right? Different specialties: psychiatry, dermatology, asthma, allergy, physical therapy, etc. And we went to our first kind of multi-specialty federally qualified health center. So this was a sizable organization that was treating underserved patient populations in the greater New Orleans area in particular. They had like 20 locations, you know, doing a few thousand appointments a week, whereas we used to see kind of a few thousand appointments a month before. And again, we were very eager. We wanted to get there quickly. It was important for us to show that we're expanding and growing and we can handle larger customers. And obviously the revenue potential there was more. But we weren't ready from a product standpoint, right? And we turned the switch on, and the product was falling over. And what I mean by that is, we messaged one poor patient there, literally like I think it was like 100 times a subpart of a second, and it was just like a bad loop that we had kind of gotten into, right? It wasn't a rocket science type fix. It was just like something we overlooked, and that was very telling for us is how important it is, any product, but especially a product that directly impacts patients, for us to measure twice, thrice. Before we cut, and I think any your listeners who are in the medical profession or aspiring to be in the medical profession know the importance of that. I think often your kind of traditional product people, especially your classic Silicon Valley product people, which is like you got to break it. Yeah, you got to break it. But when it impacts real people's lives, be very thoughtful about how you deliver change. And so that was a really important learning for us early on. I remember going out and visiting that patient and taking a handwritten apology card with a gift card to that patient. And I took it to the clinic, actually. And they said, well, that patient's here. You should just go. You're the guy. Okay, you go give it to that patient in person. And I did, hat in hand. And but that in itself was invaluable, right? Because then you understand like who the people are who are actively using your technology, your software, your product, your platform. And it's not, something that's abstract, like you can see the frustration it costs someone. And so that just drives you to build a better product and think about all the intangibles that, you can't just whiteboard. So that's one example. The other example is, I talked early on about how we're in the, really being in the business of benefiting patients, not in the business of benefiting from patients, which unfortunately a lot of parts of healthcare have kind of devolved to. And so what that's meant is we've at times made, quote unquote, bad business decisions that are the right patient decision, right? And ultimately we believe they're going to be the right business decision. But it's hard, right? When you're a super small company and every dollar of revenue counts. We had dermatology clinics that wanted to use our now pretty sophisticated messaging platform that was deeply integrated with the EHR, had AI and NLP built in that could guide a patient along their patient journey. They're like, oh, this, and the response rates were stellar, right? Like 65, 70% plus response rates. You can't ever match those response rates with a voice call or a portal or an app or any other type of engagement. And so naturally these dermatology clinics that, are run by good business people, they said, hey, we should just start leveraging this amazing communication platform, this patient relationship platform, to send out Botox Tuesday messages, right? And it was just purely marketing spammy type stuff. And they were willing to pay like top dollar for it. And we had to step back and say, hey, that's not the company that we set out to build, right? We've sent out the North Star is how do we connect more people to the right care with the right doctor quickly, and how do we make sure those patients keep coming back for care? And a Botox Tuesday message is not, it's tangentially at best related to care. And so we said no, right? And that was a hard decision because, I had a director of sales who was very well intentioned, said, hey, like, that's a huge opportunity that we're just saying no to. And our perspective was, hey, we have to maintain the purity of that channel with the patient, because if we pollute it with marketing messaging or spammy type messaging, right, you lose then that response rate that we have, which is so important to be able to guide patients along their care journey and ensure that they, that people be good patients, because it's hard to be a good patient. So that was a tough decision early on, but I think the right decision. But what it meant was, right, we left a lot of revenue on the table. And when you're at, 10, 20, 30K of recurring revenue, and you're trying to get to 100,000 and then $1 million in recurring revenue, that's a really hard decision to make. But, part of it was Tashfeen, who's our chief medical officer and is a practicing physician. And a big part of his job is to make sure that we stay focused on North Star and don't get pulled into areas that would take us away from our core mission of really being in the business of benefiting patients.
In the startup world, there's this whole debate about idea versus execution. Mm-hmm. And I think the current wisdom, at least, is that idea is 1% maybe and execution is 99%. But like from your story, it sounds like your idea was so amazing and it scratched such an itch that it was almost inevitable that it would succeed. And my question to you is, would you say that Luma's success and your success was more related to idea or more related to the execution of it?
Yeah, I still think it's execution, right? Because yes, we were, it's a mix of things, right? It's what's the famous saying that, you know, luck is what happens when preparation meets opportunity, right? So yes, we had a good idea. Yes, it was a real pain point. But there's a lot of folks who have a lot of good ideas who can address real meaningful pain points that have broad market need. And it was really that ability to execute and execute quickly. Right? When I talked about how the scarcest resource a startup has isn't actually cash or capital, but it's time. Its speed to impact is critical because every day, every hour, every day really, really counts, especially in those very early periods, those formative periods of a startup into what type of company you're going to grow up to become. And so execution is still critical. And now kind of being, you know, still a startup, but a later stage startup, kind of, you know, will be soon a Series C stage startup with you know, a couple hundred people. Execution, right? Everything is still about speed to impact. A big part of, you know, how do we maintain the right culture that allows people and encourages them and celebrates smart risk taking, which is all you do early on, right? Like you expect everything you try to blow up in your face and to blow up in your face spectacularly. But you want that to still be true when you're much larger, right? And so that's where our focus is. How do we encourage and celebrate smart risk taking? And celebrate when something blows up in our face because we learned something and we're going to be better the next time we do it, right? We're going to do more of what works and less of what doesn't. And that all ultimately leads to execution.
There's this Harvard Business Review article that I know you would have seen that talks about how there's this whole myth, especially in Silicon Valley, that all great founders are, you know, people in their 20s. And then it says that that's actually a myth and most successful founders are, I think, 45, or that's the average age.
Right.
And you founded Luma a bit later in life. Do you have any thoughts about kind of founding, you know, beyond your 20s and maybe what you brought to the table that your, you know, 20-year-old Adnan wouldn't have had?
Yeah, 20-year-old Adnan was lacking in a lot of different ways, probably most of professional maturity. You know, 20-year-old Adnan had been on teams, had led teams, but in full candor, hadn't really managed or hired or built teams. And at the end of the day, you know, every organization, every team, every company, it's really about people, right? It's people. And people remember how they feel about you, right? They don't remember what you may have done, but they'll remember how they feel, right? And so that's where it becomes really important to, not just, I think, you know, people talk about like, well, you got to do things right. But I think it's more about the framing is doing the right thing. And 20-year-old Adnan would not have known that, right? And it was through a set of experiences in my 20s, being in grad school in Cambridge, which was a very different approach and way of communication and teaching and learning style as compared to what I grew up with in the United States. Being in a graduate program that had, you know, 90% of the class, of my classmates being from different countries. So again, how do people communicate? How do they problem solve? What are those differences and nuances? Those were invaluable learnings. And then really growing up as a healthcare and then management professional at Genentech, that was invaluable training. Because at the end of the day, when you have a idea, when you are working on a project or you're trying to figure something out, you have to convince really, really good people, amazing all-star A-plus people to come join, you know, your idea, your vision, your journey, your mission. And those people have alternatives, right? Like they could be working somewhere else, making more money. They could take a more safe career choice. And, you know, many of our first 10 employees still are at Luma, and we call them, you know, force multipliers. And the goal is always to find force multipliers who come in to do a job, but then do 10x that job. And it was really the understanding of, how do you make people feel? How do you ensure that you're doing the right thing in terms of staying true to the company's mission, the vision, doing the right thing in terms of those people's career growth and development, which means, hey, if they're with you for 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, and then they're going to take a next step in their career, that's okay. And we should encourage that, right? We should have honest conversations about it as opposed to being like, oh, we can't lose our good people, right? Because you want people to grow and do the right thing for them. And that's going to be critical for us continue to attract the best talent to bring our vision to life. And so I think that for me is probably, you know, the one thing I'd say that sticks out the most is just being able to truly build, hire, and grow an all-star team, because that's the only way that one can execute, right? And bring an idea, a vision, a company journey to life. And 20-year-old Adnan did not have that. Yeah, he had a lot of energy, right? And could pull all-nighters with zero to no cost, right? 32-year-old man could still pull all-nighters, but they had a cost because I was married, right? We now have two daughters. And so there's a cost to that.
You gave this really cool talk at Stanford. I think it was called Respond or React. And maybe could you explain that framework and that thought process? Because I think it kind of links to what you've mentioned.
Yeah, you know, I think, well, thank you. That's very kind that you took the time to watch that. I don't even know if anyone sees those. But yeah, you know, Respond versus React really started, you know, I think, you know, they often say that you know, marriage is the best of mirrors because it really lets you focus on see yourself through the eyes of others, right? And you learn a lot about your deficiencies and weaknesses. And that's kind of where like that talk originated from was just in my personal relationship with my spouse in terms of, you know, rising up and responding as opposed to reacting, because we can all react right into all the different things that we get bombarded with at any given point. And so. That's hard, right? And in the frenetic pace of a startup, where there's a lot of ambiguity, a lot of chaos, that kind of respond versus react, you know, framing is incredibly important. And I think that's especially true, like for all the leaders in a company. That's most true for a CEO, where you know the buck stops with you, but you have to ultimately make a lot of decisions. Of course, in conjunction with your other founding team members, your investors, your advisors, your subject matter experts who are on your team, but ultimately there's kind of a time where a decision has to be made, right? And or a crucial conversation has to be had, or something goes terribly wrong and you have to respond to it, right? And that's where it's better to respond and do it in a thoughtful manner than to react, right? And obviously when time is tight, resources are tight, pressure is on, right? One can naturally do the quick thing, which is react, right? It's like, okay, these are the data points I have. This is what we got to get. This is what we need to do. Like, let's go, right? And I think that's where, as my role in the company in particular, is to step back and say, okay, yes, let's take the extra 30 seconds, 90 seconds, because we necessarily don't have 24 hours, right? We may just have literally 10, like 30, 90, 120 seconds. Let's step back and respond in a more thoughtful way, as opposed to just reacting to it, given what we have.
Adnan, I want to ask you a question that I don't know if it would be a bit weird, but here goes. So
please, yeah.
So I'm asking this as a Pakistani guy in Britain to a US Pakistani guy.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if, you know, being in Silicon Valley as a Pakistani guy is it a case that everyone is an immigrant there, so it's not really a thing and it's not something you would never pay attention to or would never come with any challenges? Or is it a case that there are some of those?
Yeah, no, very, very, a great question. And you know, I think I'd say there is a difference to being an American-born Pakistani versus a British-born Pakistani. And I saw this when I was in grad school in Cambridge. You know, I would find that I would experience discrimination in a way that I hadn't growing up. And part of that was I grew up in a very diverse community in Silicon Valley. There are a lot of immigrants, but I'd say the biggest difference is that you can see there are U.S. companies like the Microsofts with Satya, with, you know, Citibank at one point, with PepsiCo, with GM, right, who all have non-white leaders, right, who are CEOs, CFOs, et cetera, right? The head of Alphabet, right? He's an Indian American. The head of Microsoft is not an, he's actually from, like, born in India and, you know, probably has become an American. But I think that's helped. And you can think of someone like Jerry Yang, right, who was one of the founders and the CEO of Yahoo for a long, long time, right? So you have more examples of Asian Americans, of Latino Americans, of African Americans, people of, like, different origins, right, already who are in those positions. So at least I think that's helpful to know. That's helpful when you're growing up, because you're like, okay, well, it's not impossible, right? Like those people exist. So I think that is a big difference between what I experienced as, you know, growing up in the American academic system versus the British academic system. That being said, you know, I think, and I say this, and it may not be a popular opinion, but I think it's just the honest truth is, it is much harder to raise capital if you're not a white guy, right? And that's just the honest truth, right? And I think, and look, I have had a life of privilege, right? Where I've been able to go to the right institutions, right? Like went to Berkeley for undergrad, went to Cambridge for grad school, went to Stanford for business school. I kind of check all those boxes. I played a collegiate sport. You know, that classic profile that a VC looks for. I would check all those boxes, other than my name and how I look, right? And my name, of course, is also a very easily recognizable Pakistani Muslim name. And so I've had crappy experiences with the venture community, and those who are open to listening, because I think the venture community has finally realized that they have to change their product if they want to continue to find the best founders and the best companies. Otherwise, they're just going to miss out. And what they hate more than investing in bad companies is missing out on great companies, right? It's that, hey, if I could have raised twice the amount of money in half the time if I looked and had a name that was different, right? And I think that's just an honest perspective. And that's also true for, you know, that's also true based on gender, right? Like men are able to raise more money faster than women founders. And then of course there's the, you know, your religion, your demographic, your ethnicity, et cetera, all that comes into play. So yeah, that's just the honest truth. And I think those who wanna hear it, I'll share my opinion and point of view, and those who don't, that's fine. But I think the VC industry as a whole is really being forced to transform. And I think the ones that'll win will be the ones who adapt in the right ways.
Yeah, I think when I speak to people of my, especially of my dad and his generation, when they look back at their careers, there's often this concept of having to work twice as hard to get to where they got to.
Yeah, no, I think there's real truth to that, right? I mean, and it's okay for people to acknowledge that and talk about that, right? I don't think it's often looked as like, oh, well, like you're making an excuse, or hey, it is a meritocracy. Like, what are you talking about? And I think one of the biggest things I learned about through the fundraising process in particular was that it is not a objective merit-based process. It is incredibly subjective. Many things that you cannot control, right? If you're coming into a partner presentation and one of the partners that morning heard something terrible about digital health or health tech or how hospitals are like the worst people to sell to, right? Like that's what he or she's coming into that morning. And you could have the perfect presentation and have all the right, you know, business metrics and underlying fundamentals. But what they remember is like selling to hospitals is hard. And that can torpedo, right, that entire morning. Or someone could just have a really crappy morning. They could have been in a fight with their spouse and they're going to come in on a Monday and take it out on you, right? So that's true, like in any professional interaction, but that I found that is especially true in a fundraising venture experience where a lot of it's pattern matching. This is not sophisticated science as much as VCs would have you to believe. As a founder, I will candidly say like venture is often a necessary evil, right? To be able to bring your vision and your dream and your point of view to life. And there's great investors out there, and there's probably a lot of not so great investors out there. But even the great investors, you know, there's not a whole lot of science to it, right? There's a lot of pattern matching, a lot of looking for similar traits or characteristics into other things and other companies and other founders they've seen be successful. But that's limiting, especially if the entire partnership looks the same way and are all men, right? Like you already, I think, as a venture player, put yourself at a disadvantage because you're missing out because of even potential unconscious bias you may have or your pattern matching that is limited to a sample set that's not truly representative of what success would look like.
Have there been any habits or ways of approaching things that have helped you along your career?
Yeah, you know, I think often when I now you know speak to folks who are at Luma who want to join Luma or who moved on and it's more of kind of in a mentor mentee relationship, I share some advice I got when I was a grad student in Cambridge, and it was from a CEO of a biotech based in Cambridge at the time. And you know, he said, hey, listen, what you do in your 20s doesn't matter, right? Like what company it is, what the logo of that company is, what your role is, what your title is. None of that matters. What matters is, one, are you learning something every single day? Are you in full growth mode? And the minute your learning starts to taper, it starts to find something different, right? And then two, are you going to go work for a manager who's going to pound the table for you and get you opportunities that you may not be able to get for yourself? And hand in hand with that, are they going to stretch you and challenge you to do things that you didn't think were possible, right? And it doesn't matter if the logo is Facebook or Google or Amazon, what have you. Like, that logo doesn't matter. Like, and I see that now, right, on the other side of the table. We're interviewing folks. I don't really care which company they worked at. I don't care where they went to school. What I want to know more is, like, tell me what you did. Like, tell me the real stories, right? Of, like, when you were in a place of challenge and you had to solve a problem and you had to do it with people who were different than you. Like, how did you do that, right? And it's people who can articulate that very clearly with a lot of different examples and go deep, right? And then still be able to, like, summarize it succinctly. That's what one is looking for. And again, school logo, your title. That matters less. It's really, what did you accomplish and achieve? And for a startup in particular, you ask, how did you do it when resources were constrained, when there was a lot of ambiguity, and we had to work with a team that was very cross-functional in a very short amount of time. So I guess that's part one of it. And then the other part of it, I'd say, is just, I think it just benefited from this, where my very first job out of college was management consulting. And that's the ability to communicate and articulate a lot of data, a lot of complex things in a very simple, digestible way, right? Whether that's in an email, whether that's in a quick 10-minute pitch with someone, whether that's 15 minutes with a potential customer or someone you're getting feedback or advice from, it's to very clearly articulate, this is my ask, or like, this is the so what, lead with the thing that is most important, and provide enough commentary and color so that the person understands it, but not, kind of leading with a lot of storytelling and data and the justification and then getting to, like, the punchline, but to lead with the punchline and the so what and be very crisp and succinct and then fill in the details in whatever medium, right? Whether it's slides, whether it's an email, whether it's a visual presentation, what have you. I think that effective communication, those, what I call this, core consulting skills have really been invaluable, right? Where I learned early on how to sift through a bunch of data, but then really quickly articulate, okay, here's what matters to you decision makers. These are the gaps. These are the risks, right? This is my recommendation. And then if you want to go deep in the data, I'll take you deep in the data, right? I think naturally when you're a data nerd like we are, the inclination is to start and go deep in the data, but most people just don't have the time or the aperture to understand that. So those are probably the two things.
Are there any particular books you'd recommend looking into?
Sure. I mean, there's tons of books, about founders and starting businesses and how do you, challenge the way you do things, et cetera. But I'll start with one that is not related to that at all, but I just enjoy reading it. It's called Walking the Nile by Levinson Wood. And it's a story about a dude who has the dream to walk the entire length of the Nile. And I just found it to really be, for it to have a lot of parallels, even though I don't think the author intended to just the startup journey where you're starting kind of in the swamp, right, in the muck waters, and you're trying to get to, like, to the end of, like, this long, winding journey. And there's all sorts of trials and tribulations and things, along the way. But for me, it was more how it didn't go according to plan. Right, it was by no means perfect, but they still got to where they wanted to get to, and I think there's a lot of parallels there for a startup and a startup leader in particular. And the other one that I think is a must read, and I wish I had read it. Someone told me about it, much later as we were kind of deeper in the startup process. But it's 0 to 1 by Peter Thiel. It's not a gripping novel, but it's very authentic and just, walks through, like, all the things one has to do in terms of preparation as a startup founder. I wish I had those notes, because we definitely walked over landmines and made, kind of boneheaded errors and mistakes. And I think had I even skimmed through that book earlier on, before we embarked on the journey, it would have been really helpful, because there's just very tactical, tangible advice and notes in there that, especially before you embark on the startup journey, can be very, very helpful.
And that was amazing. Was there anything else you wanted to say?
No, thank you so much. I hope this wasn't boring, and I hope your audience finds it to be interesting and helpful. And of course, hey, look, I talked about playing the student card and having benefited from myself. If I know you're a student. I know many of your listeners are. Like, if I can be helpful in any shape, way, informed to anyone in your network, you let me know. And I think, you know, you have my contact information, and people can drop me a line if there was something interesting or something uninteresting that they wanted to challenge me on, or just to get feedback or advice on something. I'm happy to help.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. You can find all my links by going to bigpicturemedicine.co.uk. And if you've been enjoying the podcast, then please consider leaving a review on iTunes. Thank you.